Welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want positivity, hope, and examples of improving the overall health of humanity. I'm Eric. We have a different format this week, and maybe going forward, what we want to focus on first is some things we've picked up on in the news during the week, and then we want to switch into a focus on one topic. So in the past, we've talked about anything from climate change to housing to a variety of other topics, and in our second segment, we're going to focus a little bit about one of those topics, but today we're going to recap the show for the last year in a nutshell, and then we're going to finish up with a little bit of an editorial for Habanero and I, and hopefully it will not come across as whining, but it come across as uplifting. Habanero, do you want to add anything for that?
No, I'll just do my best not to be a whiner.
No, there'll be no whining. So one of the things that struck me this week is that an organization called Axios came out with a study and found that nearly 24 million United States properties are going to face house insurance premium hikes because of the risk of potential wind damage, about 12 million because of the risk of flooding, and about 4.4 million due to wildfire risk. Some private insurers are dropping policyholders, and FEMA has recently updated its flood insurance pricing model for the first time, leading to higher premiums. And then in North Carolina, close to 30% of homes across the state are at risk of rate hikes or non-renewals for home insurance because of these climate-related things. And Habanero, what strikes me is that we're still talking about, is climate change real?
It's just astonishing. I mean, I'm not sure how anybody could be watching the news. And it isn't even just here in North Carolina. It isn't just here in the United States. It's across the world. I think every day there's a newfangled catastrophe happening someplace else in the world, whether it's fires in Greece or the flooding in Indonesia and India. Turkey, I think, had recently had horrendous flooding. So it really is across the board.
Yeah, and it's just fascinating to me that business gets it. And we're still talking about it in Washington like it's where we're, you know, there's this argument about there's not enough carbon or extra carbon in the atmosphere to chase it down. It would break the economy. And I'm thinking to myself, well, it's breaking, you know, people's homes if they face flood and fire and things like that. They lose their homes. It's just a disconnect. And I don't understand, to me, why we're not a little bit more vigilant about pushing on climate change, especially when we're not going to be insured. Here's business saying there's enough risk out there of climate-related change that we're going to have to raise rates or not cover you at all.
You know, I think there's an other side of that too. So, you know, I always have to bring in the devil's advocate side or the contrary side. The expectations when somebody has a home-related disaster is different than it used to be. Now there's all these requirements to build up to new codes. There are people who expect to have things replaced as opposed to, you know, just getting fixed. So that is something that I think really has driven up the costs on the insurance side. And in also think about all of the more recent, within the last couple of years, all the supply side challenges that we've been having, all of the rising costs of all of the building materials, etc. You know, it isn't just that these things are happening. It's that when they do happen, the costs to make a homeowner whole have really dramatically increased.
Right, exactly. The evidence is mounting, and it's affecting all of our pocketbooks on some level. And in North Carolina, when I read 30% of homes across North Carolina, and honestly, a lot of them are going to be in the east, probably, because that's where, you know, the flooding occurs and the hurricanes.
Well, that's where the coastal flooding occurs.
Another study that came out, which was interesting, was a study that was published in Forbes by an organization called Vizier of 1,000 U.S.-based full-time individual contributing employees. And it found that only 4% of employees consider getting promoted to the C-suite a goal. And so, of course, the article wanted to go on and say, you know, what's happened to these motivated employees? The whole gist of it was, you know, younger people are not interested in getting to the C-suite. They don't really want their boss's job. You know, they're more interested in quality of life. And 91% cited that the prospect of associated responsibilities, stress of pressure, and working longer hours as reasons they're not motivated to get to the C-suite. And honestly, I get that. Having worked in corporate America, I totally get it. But people are going to spin this like they do. Like, we have a bunch of unmotivated young people. What do you think about that?
So the first thing that I want to say is, to me, I've also spent my life in corporate America, and I never aspired to that C-suite. And honestly, I mean, I'm really just going to be completely honest here. I never felt there was room for me at that table. You know, when I remember one of my favorite bosses, we used to talk about the tall, dark, and lovelies, and it was these tall, dark, handsome white guys who were always the ones sitting in the C-suite, or almost always. The women who were there didn't usually have any high regard associated with them. So it was nothing that I ever aspired to. And I also think of it like the athletes. So if you really think you're going to be an NBA star, or you're going to be out on that gymnastics floor at the Olympics, the chances of that are so remote. Like, why try?
And, well, another thing that struck me as I was thinking about this was, a lot of CEOs and senior leaders in this day and age don't necessarily come up through the ranks. They've kind of had a path of starting their own company. Maybe they were part of an investment bank or something, but they just were kind of brought in, and they started off, maybe they were management consultants. They started off at already a high level. And so there's this idea of, is it even possible to work your way up to a situation where you're in the C-suite? Where I've seen that happen, a lot of those folks aren't that innovative. Like, if they've been there for a while, they're just used to, they're really, really valuable for the legacy business. But in terms of that organization ever becoming an innovator, they're typically not part of it. So that could be part of this lack of interest in doing it. It's like people just not interested in sticking around for a long time.
Yeah, or they don't see that as an option, because you're not going to grow into the position. They're going to hire some guy for a ton of money, probably, you know, 20 or 50 times what you make or more, and you don't even have an opportunity to be in the running.
Well, you bring up a good point, which maybe we can talk about on another show, which is, I wonder, of these 1,000 folks they talked to, what the split was on gender lines and whether there's a difference in want to among the genders. I don't know. And I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying we have different experiences about a lot of things, habanero, gender being one of them. And I'd be curious to see whether or not there are, in fact, differences in terms, and there probably has been studies about it. But
I optimistically think that younger women probably don't have the same quite experience that I do. I've been in the workforce a long time.
Right.
So things were different when I started joining. I guess that was probably the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah. Welcome to the second part of the show. This part, you know, habanero, I wanted to do a recap in whatever we've got, 15, 17 minutes or so, and talk about what we learned. So when I look back on, we've been at this almost a year, you know, when I think about the shows we've covered, you know, we've talked about economic opportunity, we've talked about health and healthcare, we've talked about justice, we've talked about the climate. Habanero, as we've done that, what kind of lessons do you think that, what are your, in the world of consulting, key takeaways?
So I think one of the biggest ones is, it's been so incredibly humbling to realize, and you know, this has become such an overused word, but the privilege that I've experienced in my life. So even though I've had plenty of challenges, I just haven't experienced the level of what so many of the people that we've met with experience, whether it's they themselves or the populations that they're trying to help. Some of the key things that stand out to me was when we interviewed the gentleman from Homeward Bound, and he talked about that someone has to be on the street for a year before they qualify for services. Oh my gosh, what is someone supposed to do for a year? No wonder they struggle as much as they do. We interviewed an educator, president of the local board of education, or I don't remember her exact title, Shannon. And she talked about how, as a teacher with 9 years experience, and she and her family didn't always make it through the end of the month for food. It's just humbling.
Yeah, and I think it's a really great word to use, is humbling. And I'll be honest, I think candidly, my white privilege has probably been laid bare. because I have not experienced a lot of these things. And what strikes me is that more and more Americans are not able to afford their basic needs. And we're talking about food. When you start talking about the food lines to, you know, wait for food from some of these organizations that we've talked to, you know, we talk about not being able to afford the deductible on your health plan and medical debt. When we talk about, you know, not being able to get to the doctor, if you live in a rural area or in the city, when you have to take a bus or whatever to get to the doctor, you're going to skip it, you know, unless you can manage it. A lot of times you're just going to skip the appointment. And then, you know, we didn't really talk about, you know, availability of jobs. But if you look at Asheville, you know, there's not, as there is in a lot of cities, this concentration of a lot of different opportunities. There's healthcare and admission, and there's, you know, kind of the tourist industry of serving the tourism. And you just combine all those things, and this is a very different place than, I mean, place meaning the United States, than it was a long time ago. What are your thoughts about that?
You just have to listen a little bit to hear how so many things have changed with the housing and wages not keeping up, and with the value in home prices going up so high. People are in, I mean, even where I live, more than one person has been incentivized to say, an older woman, I'm going to go live with my sister because I don't know if I'm going to be able to make this killing on selling my house next year.
Yeah.
So let me go do that now. And but if they had to go rent someplace else, you can't, the mobility to go from place to place, whether it's buying or renting, is not, it is a showstopper for a lot of people.
Yeah. Related to that, something that kept coming up to me, which wasn't said, but it became like an underlying theme, was the role of wealth concentration in some of this. So because that there was a concentration of home ownership among wealthy people, that made the available supply of housing goes down, which makes housing A, unaffordable, which increases homelessness. And in every conversation we had about the climate, it was somehow the energy companies were not interested in supporting wind or solar energy. And so we continue on this path of a lack of innovation on sustainable energy. And in healthcare, we had an entire segment dedicated to how many corporate hospitals are becoming more like a McDonald's or a Walmart, where your frontline workers, and yeah, that means doctors and nurses, there's just not enough of them working. So they're burned out and they're tired and your experience gets worse. And it just strikes me as a lot of the consequences and the humbling that we're experiencing is because of this concentration. A, it could be concentration of wealth, but it's also how our industry is not, and our government is not, supporting regular folks. It's as though we know it's a problem, but nothing is really changing. And I think, you know, we're not going to get into the UAW strike, but I think that's why people are looking at this going, I get it.
I get it from meaning supporting the strikers.
Yeah, but people who maybe wouldn't have thought about supporting a union, like, yeah, I get what they're saying.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think you and I both come from union territory. So families having worked in unions, whether it's teachers' unions or manufacturing, is not an unusual thing at all. It's very unusual down south. And I think people are starting to see what the benefits could be of something like unionizing. Because otherwise you have zero leverage. You have zero leverage at your job. You have zero leverage in any of the industries. Housing, right? There's very limited housing support for tenants, I believe, here in North Carolina.
Right.
Whereas, I mean, there's so many other places where there's significant tenant rights, right? So some people will complain about that. You know, you always get people on both sides say, oh, you know, this tenant can sit here and be a squatter. But at the same time, you can't be told to vacate the place you've been living for the last 12 years with your three kids because, you know, the landlord wants to turn into an Airbnb or all of a sudden can get $500,000 for the house.
Right. Well, there does seem to be a lot more pro-regular American policies in, whether it's the Northeast or the Midwest, or everyone talks about California. And I just wonder, you know, is that good? Or maybe that's not necessarily good or bad, but it's always fascinating to me to see people struggling and also not connect the dots with that the policies around them are actually helping them to struggle and not be successful. Another thing that is related to this, but I want to get your thoughts about, is we've done a show with about indigenous people. And in that, we heard the fact is, you know, the American government, in the name of religion, pushed them off the land and took away their land, and basically separated them from society. And then they did the same thing with blacks and kept that going from slavery to segregation through redlining. And that led to this idea of, you know, everyone has a local public school. Well, if you're in a poor neighborhood, your public school is going to get funded. And so the cycle begins and you can't get out. And now there's this struggle in America because middle-class white people are the next layer of this progress. So it's the same kind of thing where it's like first it's the indigenous folks, then it's the black folks, and now it's corporate American government in the name of free markets and individual rights is now creating rural wasteland of food deserts surrounded by corporate farms. That's what I heard in all of this, but it was never really said that way. And I'm wondering, am I off my rocker or what do you think about that?
No, I think that one of the things that has happened is, you know, you talk about corporate America and it really is this faceless machine that just has a certain set of priorities, and really it's mostly revenue based. How do you make the most money? You have to keep the shareholders happy. And unless there are rules and regulations that are actually enforced, whether it's customer protections, employee protections, against price gouging, those entities are just gonna just keep going forward and steamrolling anything that gets in their way of corporate profits. My phrase for the healthcare system that we have here, which is run by HCA, a nationwide entity, I call them the Walmart of healthcare. Walmart comes in and they outprice all of the mom and pop shops. They then close, and then they're the only game in town, and then their prices go up. And that's exactly what has happened here. HCA came in, they bought up the hospitals, they bought up all the medical practices and so many of the facilities around. Now they have this bargaining power with the insurance companies, and they get to charge you whatever they want when you get sick.
It's not just charge you more higher prices in healthcare. It's passing all costs to us, whether in higher deductibles. And if you look at customer service, you can't talk to anybody anymore. Corporations do what they're supposed to do. The question I have, though, is government doesn't do anything to stop this.
It's lack of enforcement.
It's lack of enforcement. And we point the finger, depending on which side you're on, at politicians who are on your side. It's Biden's fault, it's Trump's fault. Dianne Feinstein died, worth $87 million as a United States senator. What has she done? And she's a Democrat. So I'm not necessarily pointing fingers at a Democrat or a Republican. That's a ton of money to be made. I'm not sure if you went to California, the people would say, wow, she did a great job.
I don't know either.
I'm just saying that there's this perception out there that we have this society that is, you know, being controlled more and more by corporations. And who is exactly supposed to be defending people? And I'm just not convinced it's anyone on the right or the left. It's both.
I'm going to totally agree with you.
Yeah, I'm just not seeing it happen.
You know, you get the lunatic fringe, like, and actually it goes on both sides, right? So you have the lunatic fringe on the left that says everything should be for the people and, you know, there should be all these safety nets and more things. And you have the lunatic fringe on the right that says, I got mines and F you if you can't get it, because it's a free country and we all have the same opportunity. And if you couldn't make it happen, I could make it happen. You know, don't look at my privilege. Don't look at any of the advantages I had in my life or what I might have inherited, but I did it. And if you can't do it, that's your own damn fault. I'm not bailing you out.
Right.
So that's, I think, that the two extremes that we have.
Is there anything else, any other lessons or anything exciting that you would say over the last year sticks out?
You know, one of the things that has been so amazing to me is the passion and the hope that all of these different people bring to the work that they do. So, you know, we did several segments on food, and I was so shocked to realize that all of the different ways that people, getting besides the fact that there are so many people who need food, that was astonishing to me, to just, again, the privilege to have the idea that I would have to worry about not being able to feed my children or myself. But there are people who are recovering food from supermarkets to distribute. There are people who are recovering food from farms to distribute. There are people who are capturing food after the big fancy galas where, you know, you have to make, if you've got 100 people coming, you've got to make food for 175 so that nothing runs out. And there's a tremendous amount of food left over. So it was astonishing to me not only how many people are involved in that work, identifying that need and saying, here's how I'm going to help satisfy that need, but the passion that they have for it.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's another lesson I would share, that is, you know, when we started the show with the goal of like solutions for the underaffiliated, you know, I think a lot of people took that to mean, you know, in a lot of ways, underaffiliated, you know, people who are disadvantaged, poor, disabled, all of that. And I think underaffiliated is all of us. But what struck me is the passion folks bring to serving people. And, you know, that's what it's going to take. It's going to, at the end of the day, it's those people are models for all of us. The way that they, you know, whether it's they care about homelessness or whether it's food or whether it's serving, you know, the Medicaid population or whether it's, we've had a lot of conversations about behavioral health, whether it's the climate, it's, we can't all be activists, which is, again, why the show is called Underaffiliated. We just, that's just not who we are, but we can learn from examples from folks. I'm just thankful that they're out there. I'm thankful to have met some of these folks. I'm thankful to have had great conversations with them. It's been a learning experience and it's been very inspiring. I just look at folks who do that work every day with these disadvantaged populations, and, you know, it's fantastic work.
I know, as I mentioned before, I was inspired to get involved in a way that was going to work for me. And I would really encourage anyone who's listening to find one way that they can participate in this, you know, helping your fellow man or your fellow animals or the environment or, you know, whatever it is that strikes your passion. Figure out what it is. Maybe you've got a couple hours a week or a month that you can dedicate to an organization. Maybe you can't do anything, but you can write a check. You know, maybe you could write letters or make phone calls. So, you know, find something that works for you to participate.
And that's what the show is all about. You know, look, more and more people are not able to afford their basic needs. And I say that because even if you can buy groceries, they're more expensive. And by basic needs, I'm talking about healthcare. I'm talking about affording a new car without going into debt or too much debt. And just living in a world where you're not looking over your shoulder, you're not always worried, you've got to be pretty, pretty well off to live like that. To me, that's like part of the American dream is available to some people anymore and not everybody. Habanero, would you add anything to that?
We talked about it before this past year doing this programming with you. By the way, thank you so much for asking me to co-host with you.
That's been great.
Is just how fortunate I've been. And some of the solutions or approaches that have stuck with me are, again, finding something that is going to work for you. So I know for me, when we had the gentleman from Pisgah Legal on, and he talked about the things and gave us a little flyer that said, you know, we can help you get money back on your Affordable Care Act. We can help you make sure you get all the tax credit that were available to so many people. It was amazing to me. And the next day, someone posted something on Facebook. They were in a dire situation, a single mom. And I messaged her and said, you know, call these people and see if they can help with that. That was when we interviewed the HOP people.
Healthy Opportunities Pilot.
What was the
Medicaid members.
But that was to help them through stretches of things, right? Like when there's more people that I didn't even remember the right name, but it was, you know, someone who would help you, a group that would help you if your heat system went out and, you know, you just needed a little bit of a jump if your car broke down. So it just inspired me to think, what are the things that come easy to you? Whether it's money comes easy to me so I can write a check. For me, I've been involved in the healthcare environment most of my career. So it's easy for me to be able to sit down with people and help explain to them, you know, this is what you would qualify for. And yes, this is accessible to you. So that's really the thing that has connected for me. Like, connect with something that works for you or speaks to you.
When we did talk to the Lori Stradley at Healthy Opportunities Pilot, you know, the thing that struck me really was how much we take for granted. We can start with our friends and family for support if we have a kid to take to the doctor and the car breaks down. We can afford a mechanic if the car breaks down. We don't have to take public transportation. The safety net for a lot of people is really big for a lot of white people. It's not just, oh, I've got some extra money in the bank. It's, oh, I've got friends I could stay with. And the worst case scenario isn't necessarily going to happen. And then you talk about basic needs like food and healthcare and things like that. And there's so many things we don't think about that are real stretches for folks. And the fact that we're having to build out that net for folks, I mean, that people should say, I think people should take stock in that, because that's not what this country's supposed to be about. It's not enough in my mind to just go, I'm dissatisfied with Congress. And I think most Americans are dissatisfied with Congress, but we've got to focus on the right things in my mind, which is, why are all of us affected by this? It's not a red or a blue issue. At least it's not to me. It's really an all of us issue. And when our senators and other elected officials make so much money, I mean, it's coming from corporations, and that's how our system is set up. I mean, our role in all of this is to act. And again, Solutions for the Underaffiliated is not about turning everyone into an activist. It's about merely pointing out that we are underaffiliated because we're not represented, and maybe we don't have time to be represented. I think that's what we've got to think about, is how are we going to get to a point where we're bringing back the American dream, because it's being taken away, or has been taken away, by this progression of the intertwine and interconnectedness of corporations and government. And they're doing exactly what you would expect people to do, because there's an incentive to work together. There's a ton of money to be made by partnering, and that's what they're doing. And let's just call it that and stop with the red and the blue.
Absolutely, because both sides are, you know, if you look at the big corporations, they're giving to both sides. You know, people will sit there and say, you know, this one gave this much to this party, and that's why we should hate them or boycott them. It's like, how much did they give to the other party? So very rarely is there a corporate entity that doesn't see past that and sees that we need to have lobbyists and support on both sides. And why is there only two? That's one of my biggest beefs.
Well, that's we should definitely have a conversation around that. It's talk about a monopoly on government.
Yes.
You can't get in another part. The barriers to entry are too high.
They're extraordinary.
It is just kind of ridiculous. And I would just point out one more thing, I think, which you were talking about, which is that profit is ruthlessly objective. It doesn't have a side. It's got one thing in mind. And so this idea that, like you were saying, corporations pick, I'm only going to fund, you know, a Democrat or Republican. It's like, it depends. It depends on who's going to advocate for their cause. So, again,
and you know, I'm just going to go beyond that and say, give another example. And this applies to both healthcare and to food or any other kind of consumer goods. And the two big gorillas are, that I'll use as examples, are HCA and Walmart. Both of those entities, it is in their profit-making interest to have government fund certain things. I'm sure people have heard the stories about Walmart where many of their employees are on public assistance. And gee, I can get an employee discount if I buy my groceries at Walmart.
This is not about being socialist or about being a capitalist. It's about doing the right thing under what this country is supposed to be about. And stop with the socialism, stop with the capitalism as evil or the be-all and the end-all. We just have to work together to fix it. All right, folks, we have to run. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day.